Okay, today's October 5th, 2007, and I'm here with Wilfred Woods. This is Nancy Warner, and I think this is fine. I just won't hold this very close to you.
Yeah.
I would like to just start with some background on your family and then your childhood today. I think that it's probably a very interesting childhood, and I'd just like to start there. So could you start... Some of this you told me already on paper, but if you'd say it again, when were you born?
Well, I was born in Wenatchee on September 30, 1919. The middle child of three. I had an older sister, 5 years older, who's now passed away. I have a younger sister, 2 years younger, living in Tacoma, and the three of us. We lived at 323 First Street, a house which is now the Woods House Conservatory of Music. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time growing up. Dad was gone a lot. Mother raised us almost, for the most part. Dad traveled, and, you know, being the son of a famous guy is has its own challenges. But we had a good time. Dad would take us traveling back east. He grew up in Nebraska, as did Mother. And so every few years we'd drive back to Nebraska, and visit the relatives, sometimes go on to other places in the east. In 1936... Mother was gone to a Methodist conference in Europe, and Dad was traveling, and so they left three of us in New York City all spring long, and the three of us had an apartment down in Greenwich Village in a great time for a whole spring while our parents were gone.
How old were you then?
Well, I was in high school. I was 16 years old.
Oh, man.
Traveled the subways, went to the opera. It was a great experience.
Oh, my. Oh, that sounds so fun. Huh. Well, even those family trips to Nebraska and back must have been pretty adventurous.
Yes. Oh, yes. We would stop at, we didn't go to hotels. He'd stop at, they called them tourist homes in those days. There weren't any bed and breakfasts as we know them, but there were tourist homes, and so we'd stop at tourist homes and for the night. Dad would go in and push the beds to see they were soft enough, and we'd travel. It was... Times were tough in those days. The Dust Bowl was going on. I can remember it would rain mud sometimes because of all the dust in the air, and if it rained, why, you'd really get a mess on your car.
Well, so was that here, or was that on your trips?
No, in the Dust Bowl, back in the Midwest.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, not here.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
But the 30s... were interesting times, and of course during that time my father had been chief local promoter of Grand Coulee Dam and the Columbia Basin Project, and so we would always stop and see people in regard to that. We'd visit folks that knew about dams, and he was interested in reclamation, And he would always stop for seeing old classmates of his. My father went to law school in Nebraska, and so he always remembered his classmates or family and friends. He came from, both of my parents were big, from large families. There were 10 in my father's family and 8 in my mother's, and they were scattered all over, and we would visit them. It was an interesting time.
So what part of Nebraska, central Nebraska or western Nebraska?
Eastern Nebraska, 40 miles from Lincoln, Butler County. Both of my grandparents homesteaded in the 1870s there. My father's father was a Union veteran of the Civil War, and mother's father came from Connecticut, and but they both homesteaded in a little town called Surprise, Nebraska, which is barely, I don't know that it even has a post office anymore. It's so small.
It's
everything's gone virtually now. And we have no more relatives in Nebraska. Yeah, they're all scattered all over the country.
So how many times do you remember going back there while you were a kid?
Well, I went back in the 20s, and three or four times in the 30s, and in 38 we went to Miami to put Dad on a plane to South America, drove down there. We traveled quite a little bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I want to come back to Florida and so on, but on the Nebraska thing, I'm interested in those tourist houses. How would you know where a tourist house was? Did they have signs hanging out, or was there a directory?
Yeah, they would have signs on the house, and there wasn't any problem finding a tourist home usually.
That's interesting. I just didn't know that. It's one of the many things I've never heard.
There weren't any motels. They were only hotels back in the 30s, you know. There was no such thing as a motel. At least I don't ever remember. There may have been the tourist courts. I guess perhaps there might have been some tourist courts, but we like to stay in private homes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, you know, San Luis Obispo, Chuck and I used to live there, and they advertised having the first motel in the country.
Yeah?
In San Luis Obispo. And I always thought it was a kind of a post-World War II thing, when the car became more...
Well, it might have been. I don't remember. I do remember... Wenatchee had tourist courts before the war, back in the 30s, where the Chieftain Hotel used to be was called the Yellowstone Auto Court, before it became the Chieftain Motel, for instance.
So what exactly was the difference between tourist court?
They were little separate...
Cabins.
They were cabins, basically.
Oh. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds nice.
Yeah. They were okay.
Sounds pretty nice.
Yeah.
Sounds like the kind of thing that we seek out now when we travel.
Yeah. Kind of like separate little cabins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, tell me a little bit more about what it was like being a kid in Wenatchee when you were growing up. Your house, I've not been in there yet, but it's a neat-looking house. It looks like it has a bunch of cool hiding places in it and everything.
Oh, yes. It was built in 1910 by a local dentist, and my parents bought it when it was only a year old in 1911 and moved in there. They were married in 1909, and it was a big house. The top floor was empty, was undeveloped, and so it was a great place for, you know, putting stuff, and Dad would accumulate things. People gave him a bunch of stuffed birds, I remember, and a friend of mine went up and tried to make them fly. Well, they didn't fly very, very well out the window. But we had relatives here. One of my father's sisters was the principal of Columbia School, Ethel Woods, and she lived nearby, and she would come for... we always had big family gatherings for, you know, Christmas and 4th of July and all of that kind of thing. And my mother's sister, Eva Anderson, also was a school teacher. And so there were a lot of relatives around. Dad had an older brother living up in the Methow Valley, and he would come down. He was a bachelor. And there were lots of relatives around, and we'd all gather. And then, of course, Dad's cousin Warren Woods was in the paper with us. He was the treasurer of our company, and so they would come, and their son Bob was involved in the paper with me. So we'd have big family gatherings here, and it was Dad was always interested in the circus, and as kids we would put on family circuses in that house and out in the yard, and Dad had friends with the game department, and sometimes they'd bring in animals to display, and we had a big yard and was hold circuses there in the summertime. It was really a fun time.
So would he assume his clown persona then too?
No, I don't. He was interested in the circus, but the only time that I know he ever became a clown was in 1937 when the Cole Brothers Circus came here and made him a clown, got national publicity on that. And he traveled over to the coast with them, and it was he was in Life magazine as a clown at that time. Dad had a genius for publicity. He was also pictured in Life magazine with a pair of star-spangled suspenders, and of course he'd always been promoting Grand Coulee Dam and the Columbia Basin Project, and so the press knew about him, and it was amazing how much attention he attracted. He went to Russia in 1931 with nothing but a briefcase in his hand, and then traveled all over the Northwest talking about it, wrote columns that were reprinted in lots of papers. He went back in 36 again. He traveled a lot. He went to South America in 38 by plane, which was quite unusual because they were just starting plane travels at that time in that area. He went to Asia and Europe. He was on the move a lot. In fact, he traveled a lot right from the beginning of his marriage. He would go east every year to sell national advertising, and he'd go back to New York, travel by train, of course. And so he was on the go a lot. He was away a lot from our home.
So how did he and your mother meet? Did they meet in Nebraska?
Oh, yes. They were both in this small town in Nebraska. Dad was older than mother, 5 years, but they'd known each other as children and had grown up there in that small town. And he started courting her after he graduated from high school and was in law school at the University of Nebraska.
At Lincoln,
yes. Mm-hmm.
So tell me again the story of how they chose Wenatchee.
Well, Dad and his twin had a twin brother, an identical twin, and during law school they decided to go to Alaska and look for jobs in the summertime to help support their school. And so they started traveling to Alaska every summer, got jobs on a steamboat in the Yukon River, and then would come back to law school. One summer they went to the College of Vashon Island at Burton on Vashon Island. I think it was during law school, but they settled after law school. Ralph, his twin brother, went to Tacoma in the law and became a lawyer. My father tried it out in Seattle and decided he didn't like it. He had a friend in Wenatchee, so he came over and got a job as with the newspaper here, and became editor of the Wenatchee Republic, which was edited by a very flamboyant character by the name of Fowler. And Did that for a year, then went to the Wenatchee Advance, which was the second weekly newspaper. And that was sold out from under him. And he became then the secretary of the Wenatchee Commercial Club for a year. And in the meantime, the Wenatchee Daily World had been started by 20 local Republicans. The Republicans in Wenatchee didn't like the political stance of either of the two weekly newspapers. They weren't Republican enough for them. And so they all, 20 of them, put up $100 notes to the bank and enticed two men from Seattle to come over and start the Wenatchee Daily World in July of 1905. Well, the town was only 3,000, and it didn't do very well, and they couldn't repay the bank. So in 1907, my father and his brother bought the paper. It had 460 subscribers and was barely alive, but they struggled on, and the town was growing rapidly because irrigation had just come to the valley by the Highline Canal, and so they were planting trees all over the valley. The bridge had not yet been built across the Columbia to irrigate East Wenatchee. That didn't happen until the year after they bought the paper. But there was growth going on, and so they did survive. But the Republicans did not like their independent stance. My father favored Theodore Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party. And the Stand Pat Republicans, the traditional Republicans, got together under the leadership of man who had built the Highline Canal. His name was Clark, W.T. Clark. And they turned the weekly newspaper, The Republic, into a daily in 1910 in competition to the World. And so in 1910, it was tough times for the World. We barely survived. Mother was able to get a loan from her father to buy the house that they were in. Dad had to get a loan from the publisher of the Spokane paper, Mr. Coles, to keep the Wenatchee World alive. Gave them stock in exchange for money, or a note, rather. Until 1914, they struggled on. That year, there was depression in the apple business. Apples had been planted all over the state, and there were too many of them, and the prices hit rock bottom. And so W.T. Clark decided to fold up his paper, and the Wenatchee Daily Republic stopped publishing in 14 and left the World for the field of its own. So it was a tough time in those early years, because Dad was an independent Republican. He wasn't about to toe the line. And so, he carried on from there. The World did well after that.
So you were born in 1919.
Yes.
And your sister was 5 years older than you.
Yes,
so
she was born in 14.
They started the family after things sort of stabilized a little bit, it sounds like.
Well, there were two children born in 1910 and 1912 that died early on as babies. They had gotten milk that apparently had some pathogen in them, and died as babies. So that was quite a tragedy in our family early on.
Two babies.
And then what's your sister's name, your oldest sister?
Willa Lou. And she was married to an executive with Boeing by the name of Hiltner, who was running the space program for the Boeing company. She had five children, and he died quite young. He was only in his mid-50s, and but she remarried then, and only passed away a couple of years ago, at 90 years old.
She named after Willa Cather?
I beg pardon?
Willa Cather? Did they name her after Willa Cather? That's a lovely name.
It's a lovely name. I have no idea.
You never hear it. And I just think of Boston,
yes.
I think of Willa.
Yeah,
Cather.
Yes.
So your younger sister's still alive in Tacoma.
Yes.
And what's her name?
Her name is Catherine Haley. And she married one of the members of the Haley family who are still running the Brown and Haley Candy Company, Almond Roca. And her oldest daughter is chairman of the board of the Brown and Haley Candy Company.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
We all like Almond Roca.
We all like Almond Roca.
Lots of good innovation in your family.
So your parents were, you had the big house when you were born. They had the big house, and you. So let's talk a little bit more about what it was like being a little boy. It sounds like your dad was traveling a lot. Mom was home, but tell me a little bit about your grade school years. What was like living in Wenatchee?
Well, we had fun in the summertime. We lived on the back porch. We had a sleeping porch, and my sister and I slept back there. And would run all over the neighborhood at night, of course, and had lots of friends that would do likewise. It was a safe neighborhood, you know, and we grew up there. I was four-eyed. I was nearsighted, and I was always breaking my glasses. Dr. Whidbey, who was an optometrist here and oculist, gave us wholesale rates on glasses. I broke so many of them. So I wasn't very good at sports, being always having glasses. But did play the cornet, and we had a nice neighborhood, and lots of kids were around there, and we had lifelong friends like Howard Mann and Sonny George, and there were people all around there. Dad loved kids. He would carry candy in his pockets. He was only a block and a half from work, and Dad was a gregarious sort, and was unafraid to do anything. He would gather unconventional things. Got interested in, was friends with the superintendent of the state schools, Noah Showalter, who got him interested in a medicine called HP, high powered, it was called. It had been developed by the Germans, and they were producing this ointment, a brown ointment, which was supposed to be good for most everything. Dad got interested in that, was involved in helping with the advertising of that. Dad had enthusiasms for developments of things. He went up on the border of Canada near Cascade, B.C., gotten acquainted with a lady that wanted to sell her property. So he bought a whole town site of Cascade, B.C., right up near Lake Christina, up near the Kettle River. It wasn't a good enterprise. I mean, he never had the money to really develop it. And I finally gave it up when I inherited it for taxes. But He was always interested in people's inventions. We had two garages in our house, and I remember we had an invention that a guy had made on stoves. It was a downdraft stove that Dad acquired, one of them. It burned out its grate. It was so hot. It wasn't a good invention, but he had a copy of that. He had a gold shaker in that garage. I mean, he attracted people. He was interested in what people were doing. And we have a whole bunch of useless stocks that I think he traded for advertising, probably, at the World, of the Asbestomine Paint Company, which was started here, and the Norco Oil Well Company, which was up on Wenatchee Heights. And let's see, the a sanitarium up at a lake in northern Okanagan County, and there were all kinds of stocks that he accumulated. He knew all the old-timers in the country, and they would come and visit him. They'd come through Wenatchee, because he used to write out his subscription list by hand when they were starting the paper. We had more subscribers outside of Wenatchee than we had in Wenatchee, and we had mail subscribers all over Okanagan, Grant, and Douglas counties, and he knew them all. He knew the Indians, and the chiefs would come down periodically and visit him. We have some wonderful pictures of him and a bunch of the old chiefs coming down here at Wenatchee. It was an interesting time. He was interested in seeing the country develop. He was involved early on when he was secretary of the Commercial Club. A man who was an immigration agent with the Great Northern by the name of David McGinnis came to him with an idea to irrigate the Quincy Basin. He said, "I think that we could irrigate the Quincy area from Lake Wenatchee." They got to check on the elevations. It was higher than Quincy. They got the landowners of the Quincy area, which had been settled up heavily in the early years, to form a landowners group. They got quotes, and the state of Washington actually did a survey of irrigating Quincy from Lake Wenatchee by putting a dam and a pipeline all the way from Lake Wenatchee with a big pipe across the Columbia River, a siphon, a reverse siphon. They got quotes from the steel companies for how much it would cost. And in 1914, a bond issue was put together, a state bond issue, for $40 million to irrigate the Quincy Basin, which failed 2-1. But that was evidence of his interest in getting things going. So when he went over to look for stories in 1918 in Quincy, in Ephrata, it wasn't any surprise that somebody was interested in irrigating the Columbia Basin by a dam at Grand Coulee. And he wrote in July of 1918, a story quoting Billy Clapp, an attorney in Ephrata, about a great idea of irrigating, putting a dam that would put water into the Grand Coulee and then by gravity over the whole Columbia Basin. And that idea started the formation of an organization of people that were interested in promoting the Columbia Basin project. They got Jim O'Sullivan interested, who had been an engineer living in Ephrata. They had what they called a dam university, getting information about other dams all over the world and in this country, started promoting it. At about the same time, a big-time Republican from the Yakima Valley by the name of Blaine had come up with the idea of irrigating the Columbia Basin by a gravity canal from northern Idaho. His name was E.F. Blaine. And that attracted the attention of folks in Spokane who wanted to see the Columbia Basin irrigated, and also of the power company at that time. And they formed an organization in Spokane to promote the irrigation of the Columbia Basin by gravity. They had political clout, and the legislature appropriated $100,000 to study that. They hired George F. Goethals.
Goethals,
the builder of the Panama Canal, to come out and put his stamp of approval on their idea. And the state put out a pamphlet in 1921 approving of irrigating the Columbia Basin or Gravity Canal. They compared it with the cost of a dam, but they gave no credit for any use of power from a dam at Grand Coulee, because they said there was no market for it. And so the costs of a gravity canal were decreed to be lower than that of a dam. Well, it was a big fight that went on through all of the 20s. Finally, in 1927, I believe, the U.S. senator from Yakima, by the name of Jones, put through a bill which authorized a study of the Columbia River. The Corps of Engineers was authorized to look at all of the prospects for dams and development. And a man by the name of Butler, Major Butler, took on the job of studying the river from the Snake River to the Canadian border. And his study validated the idea of a dam at Grand Coulee, which had been ridiculed by the folks from Spokane and the power company that obviously didn't want competition from public agencies. But from 1937 on, the idea of a dam began to have a little more validity. And the Bureau of Reclamation finally got interested in it. And during the Hoover administration, actually engineered the idea of a dam and of irrigation works. But Hoover was not one that was going to spend a lot of money on public works. Well, 1932 came along and Franklin Roosevelt was elected. He had been presented with the idea of it earlier and came out, made a speech in Portland during his campaign for president. And in 1933, authorized the spending of $63 million to start a low dam at Grand Coulee from public works funds. It did not require congressional authorization. He just allocated public works funds to start building both Grand Coulee and Bonneville Dam to put people to work. There were 25% unemployment in this country, and it was obvious that something drastic had to be done. And so he started the project. Well, a low dam wasn't going to irrigate anything. It was only a couple hundred feet high. Fortunately, we had a congressman from the 5th District, Congressman Sam Billingsley Hill from Waterville, an attorney from Waterville, who was the majority leader in Congress at that time. And thanks to Sam B. Hill, they were able to get the 1935 Congress to authorize a high dam and the irrigation works. I think without Hill, it never would have happened. But in 1935 on, we were assured that there was going to be a high dam. Well, it took 8 years to build the dam. It wasn't finished until 1941. And by that time, of course, the war clouds were going on, and the war started, and so irrigation took a back seat to the war, and it wasn't until after the war that the irrigation began.
Okay, that's a good summary. Nat Washington's dad was also part of the Billy Clapp group down there in Ephrata, wasn't he?
Nat Washington's father was the president of the early group promoting it. Nat's father was tragically drowned in the mid-20s at Washington Flat, along with one of Nat's brothers. But Nat was always interested in the program, and certainly his father was an early pusher for the project.
So I'm trying to imagine for you what it was like, all this stuff swirling around when you're growing up, all these politics and people are coming through your house and there's lots going on at the paper, and yeah. It must have been so stimulating.
Oh, it was.
And your experience was it must have been so different than the kids around you that were your playmates.
Well, we had people coming and going all the time, and Dad would bring folks home for dinner, and Mother was always entertaining folks. It was an interesting time. She was involved in the church. She was an ardent Methodist, and went to a lot of big conferences and church meetings and things like that. And all her family were strong Methodists. Dad's family were Baptists and Lutherans. He had a couple of brothers who were Lutheran ministers, but Dad joined the Methodist Church along with Mother, and so we went to the Methodist Church here.
So did you go to the First Methodist Church up on Washington?
Yes, and the First Methodist Church was on the corner of Chelan and Arondo Streets, where across the street from the YMCA. That was where the original church was. They built a new church in the early 50s where it is now. Yeah.
So your playmates, your kids that you grew up with, did you go up to the foothills and down to the river? How far away did you go exploring?
Oh yes, we had toe strap skis, and we'd ski all the way up to Castle Rock and ski down pieces of Castle Rock, and we were, and we had a place at Lake Chelan. Dad built in 1929 a cabin on the lake, and so we would spend summers up there. It was a really a fun time.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
So how about the river? Because the river was not developed into a trail until very recently, and so did you ever go down there?
No. The river, we didn't go near the river. The river was dangerous. Before there were dams, there were lots of drownings. I never went to the swimming holes that people went to. There were a number of them. There was one in East Wenatchee, well known. But no, I never went. Dad, folks didn't want us to go into the river. And frankly, the river was a sewer for every town upstream, and so there were lots of transients along the river. And no, we didn't go down to Shacktown, and we just didn't go down there. That was not part of our our growing up at all.
So your interest in the outdoors started as a kid with skiing and all. And
sure.
Tell me how you got into going camping and on the big hiking trips and so on.
I remember one of the first hiking trips, a man in Leavenworth called a human mountain goat took us up on horses. He hiked to up to Icicle Ridge one fall, and we camped up there with an old tent. He left us up there. I remember it because we had Kapok sleeping bags, and I remember never being so cold in a sleeping bag as it was snowing, and I kept getting closer and closer to the fire. It burned holes all over that Kapok sleeping bag when I finally woke up. It was a miserable night.
What month was that?
Well, it must have been late summer or early fall. That was one of my early experiences. Dad wasn't much of a hiker. He would take a horse, but he was kind of heavy, and he loved the outdoors, though. He was in love with the mountains. Having grown up on the plains, he came to this part of the country and was in love with mountain country. And he'd like to go up on top of a mountain and roll rocks down. Something you wouldn't do today.
Well, some people still do.
Some people do, too. That's right.
So did you go up to Lake Wenatchee when you were a kid at all, or did you always go up to Lake Chelan?
Well, Chelan was our although my cousin's family had a place at Lake Wenatchee, and but we would preferably go where we had a cabin. That was Lake Chelan. In fact, they used to camp at Lake Chelan at First Creek before they got a cabin, and before that, in the 20s, the folks had a cabin up Mill Creek, off of Blewett Pass. It's on the road. It's on the the road that goes over to Leavenworth, the Mountain Home Road. It's on that road.
Oh, right.
Dad had a quarter section of land up Mill Creek, and of course that road that goes over there now wasn't there now, and we had it was timbered. And they built a cabin in there, and the folks always had girls that worked for them that looked after us kids. And I don't really remember those days of going up to Mill Creek, but we have pictures of the early days. And, we always had camping going on of some kind.
So did you do hunting? Did you ever do any hunting?
No, I never was a hunter and not much of a fisherman either. Yeah.
So the families that you grew up with, were they mostly in small businesses and in orchards, or
when you think about it?
Well, I grew up with Howard Mann a half a block away. His mother was a teacher in the schools. His father was retired. Sonny George, I don't remember what his father did. I remember that his father, during the Depression, was hand-cutting jigsaw puzzles and selling them. I remember the Peach family, whose father was collecting pollen and was a beekeeper, as I recall. Up the street was Royal Weinstein, whose father had the fashion shop. And the Hoffman family lived across the street, and they had a meat market. At the other end of the block, the Grosses were preachers, and the Probst family were also preachers. They grew up in the same block with us. The Roddies were a block away, and they were, I don't remember what he did. I think he was in the fruit business. There were just lots of families all around.
You have such a good memory. That's great. That gives me a feel for it. That's good.
Yeah.
So in high school, you went to, there was only one high school for East Wenatchee in Wenatchee, right?
That's right.
Could you talk about that?
Yes. Well, Wenatchee High School, when I went there, when I went to junior high school, the junior high school had just been built and hooked on to the old high school. And H.P. Ellison was the principal. He was a favorite guy. And the principal, the longtime principal of high school, was a man who was a favorite of everybody who went there. Oh, my God, I can't remember his name. I'll remember his name in a minute. But he was an orator. And taught us the biggest Sunday school in town. And he was the principal of the high school for a long, long time here. And he retired the last year of high school. And I'll think of his name, but it was a traditional high school. I played in the band and the orchestra, and I was involved with the High Y Club at the YMCA, and learned to swim at the Y, and the Y was very active at that time. I did not carry a paper, but the paper would put out special editions for special fights, for the World Series, for elections, and then we would put out extra editions at 5 a.m. in the morning. And so we would, as kids, we would get up for those special editions and carry papers up and down the streets selling extras.
5 in the morning?
Yes. Yeah.
That sounds pretty hardcore.
Well, it was a nice way to make a little extra money. Buy them for two for a nickel and sell them for a nickel.
Wow. So how long did you do that all through high school?
Well, it was whenever there was extras going on, why, sure, we would go out and sell papers. I sold, when I was in, this was when I was younger. When I was in high school, I was, they would catch me, I would go into the newsroom and swat flies for them. Help out like that.
Starting to introduce you to
but
the business.
But most of our summers were spent up at the lake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Kathy? Did you meet here in town or did you meet in college?
No. Kathy had graduated from Washington State University, and I went to Chelan to do a piece in the summer of 1951 about Chelan. We were putting out a special edition about Chelan, and she was running the office for the Chamber of Commerce, and so I went in and got acquainted and asked her for a date, and I asked her to go on a date, and we went to Hart's Pass, and I'd forgot to tell her that we were going on a hike. And she was wearing sandals and a tight skirt, but she brought along a lunch that her sister-in-law had made of fried chicken. We hiked up Slate Peak. There wasn't any road up there. There was a trail that went up to the lookout that was up on top of Slate Peak at that time. She says she doesn't remember doing anything but lying down on the bed and gasping for breath. That was our first date.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that was a good test, I suppose.
We were married that December of that year.
Oh. So you went into the war before you met Kathy. You did the whole war experience before you met Kathy. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I was sort of assuming that you had gone to high school together or something, but.
No,
Oh, okay. So let's back up to high school. And you're
high school, yeah.
You graduated from high school.
I graduated from high school in 1937. Went to work for a year, then went to college for 2 years, then went to work for another year, and then college for a year, and then I was drafted in 1942. And I went into the Air Force. They sent me to Air Force headquarters in San Francisco, which was a delightful place to spend a year and a half or 2 years. And then I was sent to Edwards, what is now Edwards Air Base. It was called Muroc Air Base, which was the cadre of the nucleus of the very first Air Force's jet group. This was the very original group of jet planes. I was not a flyer. I was a desk pilot. And we organized a jet group there for the first jet plane, which was called a P-59. It wasn't a very good jet. It was a twin-engine jet, but it didn't do a very good job. But it was followed by P-80 of Lockheed after about a year. And I spent the whole war with that, the remainder of the war, with the 412th Fighter Group in Southern California. The end of the European War came before we were operational. And they didn't need jet fighters in the Far East. They needed bombers. So we spent the rest of the war in Southern California with the jet group. And that's where I had my war experience, all over Southern California.
Yeah. Okay. I know that country. That's where I was born.
Well, I was stationed first in Palmdale, and then in Bakersfield, and then in Santa Maria. Yes. And I had a motorcycle, and so my brother-in-law was teaching at Caltech at that time in Pasadena, so I would spend lots of weekends down in Los Angeles. And,
interesting. So that was Willa's husband?
That was Willa's husband, yes.
Wow, neat.
Yes.
That was neat to have him down there when you were down there.
Yeah, so we had a good time. And I would go up to San Francisco, and, you know, motorcycling was easy, and I would trade my stamps for gasoline. My cigarette stamps I'd trade for gasoline, so that'd work out okay.
So did you go to, did you ride up the Big Sur coast? Highway 1 wasn't there yet, though.
Yes, that's right.
Was it there? I mean, there were dirt
roads. Up the coast?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Sure? Oh, yes. Well, oh, yes. Yes, there
was. It was built in the 30s.
Yes, yes, it was built in the 30s. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, how fun.
Oh, yes. But I would put on two pairs of pants at night to go from Pasadena up through Santa Barbara and on up the coast to Santa Maria, because it was, the fog would come rolling in. It was cold.
Very cold. Oh, yeah.
I didn't have any leathers.
No. Oh. Wow. So did you ever go to the Carrizo when you lived in Bakersfield? You know the Carrizo plane? It's this isolated place between Bakersfield and San Luis Obispo, if you were riding straight over to the coast.
I never went across that way.
Oh,
no.
That's where we lived for
several years. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, that's neat.
Yes, I used to hitchhike. Before I got that motorcycle, I'd hitchhike into town on highway, well, it's now the I-5, hitchhike from Bakersfield on into Pasadena.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pasadena was beautiful.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh. That was a beautiful town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
So then after you were done with your service,
yeah,
you ended up going to Europe on another detail or something, didn't you?
I finished my college at UW and came back to the world in 47. Graduated in 46. 47, I was working at the world. And 48... I was a photographer for the news department during the great flood of 48, And that was an interesting time because it was the biggest flood that the region had seen since 1894. And the Wenatchee pumping plant was flooded out for a while. It came clear over Worthen Street. And the whole of the Methow Valley, every ridge in the Methow Valley was washed out. The Okanagan Valley was awash. The paper was flying papers into the Okanagan Valley because everything was washed out. The Wenatchee Valley was a mess. It was really a terrible time.
Now, those were summer storms, as I recall. I've heard about it in Douglas County. They were summer, big summer rainstorms.
This came at the peak time of, this was late May and early June. The Columbia peaks in late May, normally in early June, and there were a whole series of cloudbursts all up and down the mountains, and there had been lots of snow because it was a cool spring and a lot of snow. And so it all came at once. Yeah.
So you've got all those photos that you took here archived at the paper?
Well, we have a lot of them, yes.
Wow, that'd be interesting to look at those.
Yeah, I hope we have them. I haven't looked at them in recent years.
That'd be really interesting to go looking for those.
So. I'm not sure. A lot of stuff got dumped, unfortunately, and I'm not sure that we've got those original photos still or not. I believe there was a cleaning out in the late 40s, and I'm not sure that we still have those. Do you want to take a break?
I think we're full here.
All right. Fair enough. So. Well, we've been going on.